Greetings, my name is Yitzchak Et Shalom, and it is my honor and pleasure to study Megillat Rut, the Book of Ruth, together with you via these podcasts. The podcast you are about to hear was originally recorded and sent out via the internet in the year 2007. It is now being resent so that in this series we will complete our study of Megillat Rut from chapter 1 through the end of chapter 4. I hope that you enjoy, and may we continue to grow in our study of Torah together.
Greetings, and welcome back to our twice-weekly podcast on Tanakh, on studying text from the Tanakh. And we are now beginning, in anticipation of the upcoming festival of Shavuot, a series on Megillat Rut, and hopefully we'll be able to complete our study of Megillat Rut by the festival of Shavuot, or at least soon thereafter. It is most recommended that you arm yourself with a copy of the text of Rut, and indeed with an entire Tanakh, entire Bible, because we will be looking at verses in all sorts of parts of Tanakh, especially in the book of Bereshit. As we will see, the book of Rut is very much associated, and there are many allusions from the book of Bereshit and part of the book of Shemot, of Genesis and Exodus, that are found in Megillat Rut. Megillat Rut, just a couple of words of introduction. First of all, there is an ancient custom, goes back at least to the times of the Gaonim, if not earlier, so that goes back to the 8th century or before, to read Megillat Rut publicly on the festival of Shavuot. However, there is no reason given with the original custom as to why Rut is read on Shavuot. And all sorts of theories have been posed. The most common theories are that Rut was the prototypical convert, and the Shavuot, which celebrates the stand at Sinai, was the mass conversion of the entire people to come into the covenant with God. Also, the fact that to demonstrate how much the Torah, which is all about kindness, and the great reward for those people who perform kindnesses, as Rut and everyone else does, pretty much, in this Megillah, as we will see. Another common explanation is given is that there is a passage in the Palestinian Talmud, in the Talmud Yerushalmi, that indicates that David, Rut's great-grandson, who is the telos of this entire book, as a look at the last passage and the last word in the Megillah will indicate, that he passed away on the festival of Shavuot, and as such, to celebrate his yahrzeit, if you will, the commemoration of his death, we read Megillat Rut. Possibly what is the simplest explanation is that the entire book of Rut focuses around issues of the harvest. And Shavuot is Chag HaKatzir, the festival of the harvest. But every one of these explanations is interesting, and every one of these explanations leaves something to be desired. Nonetheless, such is the custom. And so we will devote our energies during this period to studying Megillat Rut. For those of you who were with us before Purim when we studied the Book of Esther, we will resume our study of the Book of Esther either in the summer or perhaps after the holidays, and perhaps over the summer we will engage in other study. In any case, Megillat Rut. A word of introduction about Megillat Rut. Megillat Rut is one story. A look at the Masoretic text indicates that it's all one paragraph, one very long paragraph, one story, until the last five verses, which are an epilogue, which really are not part of the story themselves. And as such, it's really one story. However, the Christian division into four chapters, now is a division which we all operate with, in this particular case, unlike many books in which the chapter division really violates the spirit of the text and the proper breakdown of the text, here it really does operate quite well. And as such, we will be utilizing the chapter divisions in our study. In today's shiur, chances are we will not get past the first five or six verses, but the five or six verses themselves comprise a separate unit, and so we will try to complete that unit. The book is presented to us as having taken place during the period of the Shoftim. A couple of marks about the period of the Shoftim, because they put tremendously significant background against which to read this story. The period of the Shoftim. which is commonly mistranslated as Judges, the book that follows Joshua, Joshua and Judges, Yoshua Shoftim, Shoftim or anything but Judges. A quick look at chapter 2 and chapter beginning of chapter 3 of the book indicates that a judge there was really a chieftain or a guerrilla fighter, somebody who would lead a rebellion and ultimately a revolution against the oppressing overlords who were ruling over Israel as a result of Israel's moral and religious failures. So during this period of the Shoftim, however, there are several salient features that are common to the period. One of them is that the book of the Shoftim, by and large, focuses on the tribal unit and occasionally on the national unit, and there is very little attention given to the individual, except insofar as the individual may be a Shofet. You find out something about where he lives, who his family is, some of his early deeds, as we find out in the case of Gidon, some of his tragic family interactions, as we find out in the case of Yiftach, etc. But for the most part, everything operates there on a tribal level, except for the two stories that end the book of Shoftim, which are sort of prototypes of terrible events and terrible behavior that took place during the period that are exemplified by those two awful stories in chapter 17 and 18. The pestle of Micha, the idol of Micha, and 19 through 21, the last three chapters, which is the famous story of the concubine of Givah, Peleg Givah, and that terrible tragedy. And even that story takes place for the most part on the tribal level, not on the individual level. On the other hand, Book of Ruth is all about individuals and small family units. So that's one piece in which this book is in the time of the Shoftim, it gives us a very different face of what was happening. Writ large, the period of the Shoftim was a period of terrible sinning and of a constant backsliding into idolatry, which was immediately met with God's wrath, which would have resulted in an oppressor coming in and successfully subjugating one tribe or another tribe, or many tribes, or evidently in one case all of Am Yisrael, which led to the people being enslaved for X amount of years, after which they would cry out to God. God would immediately, and this is critical, would immediately raise a Shofet, who would then lead them to victory with one strategy or another, and then afterwards things would be quiet until he died. He would usually live for 40 years, 80 years, certain long period after the victory, after which they would backslide again. In other words, the period of Shoftim is on the one hand marked by terrible sinfulness on the part of Am Yisrael, but on the other hand, by a very quick reaction by God to the people's behavior, both in a good way and in a not so good way. In other words, when the people are crying out to God, God immediately has compassion and sends a redeemer. When the people sin, God immediately sells them down the river, as it were. Vayim Kerem Biyad, Kushan, Biyad Eglon, etc. So there is an intimacy and an immediacy about the relationship between Bnei Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, between the Jewish people and God, in Shoftim. And on the other hand, when we look at the book of Ruth, we find that everybody in Ruth is good. Everybody behaves well for the most part, with certain questions about some of the characters we meet at the beginning who are simply foils who disappear. But the central characters, all of them are good characters. The only difference is some of them are spectacular and the others are just fine. But on the other hand, God's presence is not felt very much in the book of Shoftim as a direct presence, in the book of Ruth as a direct presence. Unlike Shoftim, where every time that the Jewish people or a tribe behaves a certain way, God responds immediately either to favor them or to oppress them. Indeed, God's name, which is very prevalent on the lips of everybody in Megillat Ruth, as we will see, is not mentioned very often, certainly not in a positive fashion, by people in the book of Shoftim. So it's almost as if this is the anti-Shoftim. This book represents everything Shoftim is not. On the one hand, it's about an individual family. On the other hand, it's an individual family of people, and the people who connect with them who are all good people and doing fine things, people who mention God's name, and yet God's presence is not felt with the same immediacy that it is felt in the period in the book of Shoftim. Parenthetically, if we follow the chronology, this story should have taken place towards the very end of the period of the Shoftim, because after all, the child who was born at the end of this book is the grandfather of David. And David comes along well after this period as a young man who then becomes the king. So this could not have happened at the beginning or the middle of the period of the Shoftim. It had to happen towards the end. All right, enough introduction. Let's study some Torah. Vayim b'meshvot ha-shoftim. It happened in the period of the Shoftim. Vayim ra'ad ba'aretz. There was a famine in the land. That phrase itself is a phrase that should take us back to one book and really one book only. And that book is the book of Bereishit. There's three famines that happen in the book of Bereishit, in the book of Genesis. So the first thing that happens when I'm reading this book, immediately I'm drawn back to Genesis. And that's critical because there will be a lot of Bereishit or Genesis terms that are used in the book of Ruth. And what the text seems to be doing is to drawing us back to that period. Now, what is the book of Genesis? We have to, sort of in a general sense, what is the book of Bereishit? So as the Ramban, as the Maimonides says in his introduction to the book of Shemot, to the book of Exodus, he points out that Bereishit is not just the Genesis of the world, it's the Genesis of the nation. And the formation of the nation, and all of the promises, and all of the commitments, and all of the covenants, and all of the prophecies that were given in Bereishit are things that then came to fruition in later books. So this is the formation of the nation. When we hear allusions to the book of Bereishit and the very beginning of the book of Shemot, of Exodus, we suddenly are drawn into the sense that, aha, we're ready for a new sort of beginning or a new Genesis, and that indeed is what's going to happen. So there's a literary framework that is being created by the use of words of the author, a framework of a new beginning. Now, when were the famines? So the first famine that we hear about is in Genesis 12, when Abraham has to go down to Egypt because of a famine, and that's where troubles happen with his wife, who he presents as a sister, and she's taken to Pharaoh. The second famine happens in his son's lifetime, that's Yitzchak, and Yitzchak, Isaac, ends up going to Gerar, near the coast, on his way to Egypt, and God says to stay there, and so he stays there with his wife, and evidently with his two sons. Keep that very much in mind. And then the third famine, of course, is in a sense the most famous one and the most tragic one, famine that is foretold by Joseph's interpretation of Pharaoh's dreams, which leads to Joseph's entire family coming down to Egypt and settling there, which ultimately leads to the terrible servitude, which we celebrate the liberation from that servitude on Pesach. Good. So I hear Avbaret. So now we already have an expectation of exile, because that's what happens whenever there's a famine. It's a famine in the land, people leave to go somewhere else for a short period of time to try to find sustenance and then come back. So, what do we have? Vayelech ish mi beit lechem Yehuda, lagor bistei Moav, hu vishto shnei vanav. This is the information. A man from Beit Lechem, and we're going to talk about Beit Lechem because it's the central town in the entire story, Beit Lechem of Yehuda. Beit Lechem literally means house of bread or house of food. Of Yehuda, lagor b'shdei Moav, to sojourn, meaning to go for a short visit to the fields of Moav. Moav is in southwest Jordan, but it is southeast of Beit Lechem. It is not a long walk, it's a few hours walk to go down from the hills of Beit Lechem, of Bethlehem, down towards the Dead Sea, and cross over, and then to go to Moav. It's not a great distance. Hu v'ishto, he and his wife, and his two sons. So now, the main part of this verse is, of course, missing, which is, we got a man, we got his wife, we got his two sons, no names. We know they're from Beit Lechem. We can presume, although not with 100% certainty, that they're from the tribe of Judah. But let's talk about Beit Lechem for a moment, and then about why the text would leave their names out. Beit Lechem. Why would a town be called Beit Lechem? So first of all, why is this called Beit Lechem Yehuda? And most of the mentions of this town, the tribal identity is added, because there are other towns called Beit Lechem. First of all, the text in Joshua 19, Yoshua Yotet, tells us that there is a town called Beit Lechem that belongs to the tribe of Zevulun up in the north. Second of all, in the book of Ezra Perek Bet, there seems to be another Beit Lechem, which belongs to the tribe of Binyamin, which is north of Jerusalem. Why would there be so many towns called Beit Lechem? Well, the truth is that there are quite a number of names of towns which have multiple places called by that name. There are at least five different places called Gilgal. There's at least two and perhaps three different places called Ramah. Why are there so many places that, why are there so many names that that occupy different places with the same name? The reason is because these are names that describe either something about the agriculture of the place or something about the formation, the rock formation of the place. So Gilgal, which means round, is a place of round rocks. There's a Gilgal up in Samaria. There's a famous Gilgal down at the Jordan River. Perhaps for similar reasons, perhaps for synonymous reasons, as it were, homonymous reasons, that the same word has different meanings, and that therefore the different places have the same name. A Beit Lechem, of course, is a house of bread. What is a Beit Lechem? It is a city that is amidst wheat fields. And because it's in the middle of wheat fields, essentially of an area that's rich in wheat, so at some point in time, when it began to be farmed, the people identified a location in the middle and built a town around it where people would trade their wheat, and where people would mill their wheat, and where people would bake bread, etc. So that's what a Beit Lechem is. That's why there's several of them. So that's why this has to be identified as Beit Lechem Yehuda. The second thing that we get from this, if it's a Beit Lechem, that means the area around it is an area of wheat fields. And that means that the famine here affects the wheat. And that means that this fellow is very likely somebody who, in one way or another, is involved with the growing of, or the selling of, or the processing of wheat. Good. So that's who this fellow is. Again, we don't know who he is. What's really startling, of course, is that his name is not mentioned. Now, one other feature about the verse, we noticed already that there is a Breshit connection. There's also a Shmot connection here, and a very critical one. When you have the phrase, Vayelech Ish Mi Beit, a man went, and we don't know the man's name, a man went from the house of, that immediately brings us back to the very first verse, the second chapter of Shmot, of Exodus, Vayelech Ish Mi Beit Levi, Vaykach Et Bat Levi. A man from the house of Levi went and took a daughter of Levi, and of course that marriage produced the Redeemer, which is Moshe, and so we get a sense again here of being brought back to beginnings, being brought back to the anticipation of the birth of somebody who's going to be a savior and a great leader, etc. So there's all of this anticipation that's built up in the mind of the reader. And then we're told that there's a man and his wife and two sons, and we're not given any names. Now the text will do this for one of three reasons, and sometimes two of those reasons will apply. Sometimes the text will leave names out because we don't want you to get distracted with the names. So, and in that same example, Vayelech Ish Beit Levi, Vaykach Et Bat Levi, a man from Levi took a daughter of Levi, and they had a son. We don't find out the son's name. We don't find out the father's name, not the mother's name. There's a sister in the story. We don't find out her name. We find these names out later on. We never find out the baby's name because he gets an Egyptian name by which he's known, which is Moshe. We never find out his name, his birth name. Sometimes the text will leave names out because either the characters are not important, that'll happen, and that happens, for instance, in at the end of the Book of Shoftim, in that terrible story, there are no names given to anybody, and in some cases because the people may be important, but right now we don't want you to get distracted with those particular names, we want you to keep your focus, in this case, on a little baby in a basket in the reeds. Sometimes the text will do the exact opposite. It wants to draw tremendous attention to the name, so it builds up suspense. Who is this? Who is this? And then it'll tell you the name, and you got to pay attention to the name. Either you'll be surprised as to who it is, or more frequently, you will be surprised and intrigued by the name itself. There's something about the name that's interesting. Good, so let's see. The third reason it'll happen is, so you have the notion of suspense, and you have the notion of the significance of the name, or on the other hand, perhaps the insignificance of the person or the desire not to get you distracted. In this case, I believe that it is both the issue of suspense, but also the significance of the name. Because the second pasuk turns around and says, and here's his name. So instead of telling us right away, a man named Elimelech and a woman and his wife, Naomi, and their two sons, Machlon and Kilion, went, it said a man and his wife and his two sons. And by the way, it's his two sons, not their two sons. Which means that we're putting him as center stage. This man, who we'll find out his name is Elimelech, he picked up and left. He took his wife, he took his two sons, which seems to put the onus for leaving on him. Which means that if this family somehow does not make it back immediately, do some farming, get some money, get some food, and then come immediately back, we're going to put the onus on him and say, you are the one who took your family there for a short time, and you remain. And that's exactly how it's going to play out, and let's see what happens. V'shem ha'ish Elimelech. So we now find out the man's name is Elimelech. Elimelech's a great name. It's a beautiful name. My lord is king. Elimelech. V'shem ishto Naomi. His wife's name is even better. But it's again his wife. Man, his wife, which means it's all focused around the man. What's her name? Naomi. The name Naomi has two different words in it. One of them is Noam, which is pleasant, pleasantness. And the other is Ami, my nation. So this is a woman whose name just speaks of all sorts of wonderful things. Pleasantness, connection to the nation. And of course, this is a woman who right now is somewhat unpleasant, not unpleasant in demeanor, but is suffering and doesn't feel pleasant because there's a famine. And a woman who has separated herself from her nation. Of course, that's her husband took her. V'shem Shnei Vanav, and what are the names of his son? His sons, Machlon V'Chilion Ephratim. And Machlon V'Chilion are very troubling names. The reason is because on a simple read, the name Machlon means sickness, Machala. And the name Kilion means destruction, Kliya. Now, who would name their kids Machlon and Kilion? Very strange. So we have one of two options here. Option one is that the names mean something else. And indeed, a fellow wrote an article, I don't remember his name, a couple of years ago, in which he argued that both Machlon and Kilion were really positive names. Machlon from Chali, a jewel, and Kilion from a Kli, also some sort of a pendant. Certainly possible. The other possibility is these are what we might call edited names. They had some other names, and that after the terrible thing that happened to them, text gives them slightly different names, or totally different names, to reflect sort of how we think about them. Either way, and we'll never solve it, they are identified as Machlon V'Chilion Ephratim. They are from Ephrat, which is Beit Lachem. Beit Lachem Yehuda. And again, from Beit Lachem Yehuda, there's a stress here that they come from Beit Lachem Yehuda. The notion that they come from a center of wheat and they're leaving because of the famine perhaps puts some sense of abandoning ship in our judgment of them. We don't know. Vayavo stei Moav vayusham. Already the music in the background should turn very minor. Which is Vayavo stei Moav. They came to the field of Moav vayusham, and they were there. They were there, and makes it sound like they started settling in. What's the very next thing that happens? Vayamot Elimelech ish Naomi. And notice how subtly the text shifts the spotlight. Up until now, the spotlight was on the man. He was center stage. And in his periphery were a wife and two sons. Suddenly, he, Elimelech, is called ish Naomi, the husband of Naomi. And Naomi is suddenly center stage, and we're going to be a lot happier about that eventually. Elimelech dies. Why did Elimelech die? We have no idea. But the sense of Ayusham, the sense that they came to the field of Moab and they stayed there, is a sense that, well, maybe they said they were going to go for a short time, but they kind of settled in. We don't know. The Chazal say, the rabbis say that Elimelech died because he left Eretz Yisrael, or because he didn't want to support the poor in his community, and he was a man of means. Some reason they ascribe. In any case, we are not given a clue. And so now who's left? Naomi and her two sons. Now this is a terrible predicament to be in. Here is a widow who in the ancient world is really vulnerable. She has two sons who at this point are not married. They're in a foreign land. They are not wealthy, at least. They don't seem to be of means now. They've left because of a famine. And she is alone. And now, really, a death knell sets in, which is the two boys marry Moavi women. Why is this a death knell? Well, there's several reasons. First of all, the Torah prohibits marriage with Moabites. Right? Text in Deuteronomy, in Tvarim, says you're not allowed to marry a Moabite. So yes, we understand halachically, and in light of the story of Ruth, that the prohibition is only against a Jewish girl marrying a Moabite man who is converted. Fine, so Moabite woman is permitted, Moavi, v'lo Moaviyah, etc., understood. Nonetheless, Moav is still, it's not as if it's desirable or a good idea to marry a Moavi person, because the Moabites are our neighbors, and they're not such great neighbors. Now read the first chapter of Amos, read the third chapter of Malachim Bet. I mean, there's lots of places in Tanakh where the Moabites are not such great neighbors. And in very few cases are they good neighbors. So this is another thing that we don't feel good about. But on a third level, a much more substantial, which is they left there because of a famine, which means they're going to come to the foreign land be there very quickly, wait till the famine's over perhaps gather some money, some food, and go back. The minute that they marry local girls, that's pretty much it. They're not going to leave. They're married into local family. And so we have a very sinking feeling about this. And by the way, we have a sinking feeling for another Bereshit reason. When was the last time we heard about somebody leaving Eretz Yisrael because of a famine and then marrying a local girl and as a result settling in? Well, that was Yosef. Of course, in Yosef's case, the context and the framework is very, very different. And that story plays out first tragically, but then gloriously. Here we don't know how it's going to play out, but at least we should be aware that there is a somewhat of a similar framework and a pattern happening. Good, so they marry Moavi women. Shem ha'achat Orpah v'shem ha'shenit Rut. What are their names? Well, one of them is named Orpah, and one of them is named Rut. And by the way, we're not told until the very, very end of the book who married whom, because it really doesn't matter. The point is that these two men of Yehuda married two Moavi women. One is Orpah, and the word Orpah, although it's unlikely it's a Hebrew word unless it was translated, probably a Moavi word, nonetheless, in Hebrew, Orpah comes from the word Oref, which is the back of the neck. Keep that in mind, because we'll see Orpah's back of the neck. And the other one is called Ruth. Ruth, of course, who is our heroine, has a name that we really can't decipher as to what it means. There are those who suggest that there was an ayin in there that got dropped out, and the name really is Reut, which is friendship, would be perfect for the story, but ayins don't generally drop out that quickly. So we don't really know what Ruth is, but that's her name. And they stayed there for 10 years. 10 years is not a short visit. So they stayed in Moab for 10 years. And why did that period end? It ended because they also died. Machlon and Kilion also died. Which means now, what's Naomi got? Naomi's got no sons. By the way, in the ancient world, is a terrible curse because you got nobody to work in the fields, nobody to take care of you. She's a widow. She's buried two sons, and she's got two former daughters-in-law with whom she has no connection anymore. And as we see in the text, quite clearly, they have no children, which means she's got no blood relations and no marital relations, nobody she's married to, no relations whatsoever, and she's in a foreign country, and she's got these two girls who were married to her sons. So she would fully expect those two girls would go back to their parental home as widows. And then Naomi would be alone and would probably make her way back to Beit Lechem. That's what we would assume. So now, to repeat what we saw two verses ago, the woman is now left without her husband and without her two sons. So now, Pasuk Vav, and with this we're going to end first year. Vatakom hi v'chaloteha. Now, there's something about the Hebrew grammar here. Vatakom means she got up. Who got up? She got up and her daughters-in-law. So the first thing is, they're called her daughters-in-law, even though they aren't her daughters-in-law anymore, which indicates that they've got some sort of relationship which transcends the lives of her sons. That's first of all. Second of all, the verb used is in the singular, vatakom. It should say, vatakomna. She and her daughters-in-law all got up. But instead it says, she got up and her daughters-in-law. Why is that the case? Well, this is an important piece of biblical grammar to understand, is that whenever there is a group that acts, but the acting is led and motivated by a leader who instigates the action, who everyone follows, etc., it is often described in the singular, the verb in the singular, even though a group is doing it. Example one is Exodus 15:1, Shmot Tevav Pasuk Aleph, Az Yashir Moshe Ovnei Yisrael. Then Moses sang in the singular, and the children of Israel. We're talking about several million people singing, and yet it's described in the singular. That's because, a simple read is that Moshe led them. Second example, Bamidbar Yudbet Aleph, Numbers 12:1, Vatadaber Miriam V'Aharon B'Moshe. Miriam and Aaron spoke evil about Moshe, but it's Vatadaber, she spoke. Why is that? Because Miriam evidently spoke. Aaron listened, Aaron participated, but Aaron didn't speak. Third example is in Shoftim Hey, Pasuk Aleph, fifth chapter of Shoftim. How does it start? Vatashar Dvorah uVarak ben Aminoam. Dvorah and Barak sang, but it's in the singular, she sang. Because evidently Dvorah led the singing and Barak assisted her and responded. However, we don't want to read it. Same thing here. Naomi is the one who gets up. Her daughters-in-law are not going to get up to leave Moab on their own. The astounding thing is that when Naomi gets up to leave, they go with her. Atashov Miste Moab. And she returned from Miste Moab. Why? Ki Shama Miste Moab Ki Fakar Adonai Tamo Latet Lahem Lachem. What did she hear in Miste Moab? That God had remembered his people to give them bread. In other words, the famine was over. This, by the way, is the only place in the entire Megillah that we actually hear God acting. God had remembered his people and had brought them bread. The famine was over, and now they could return. Good. We're going to end the shiur here with just a couple of summary notes. In the first six verses of chapter 1, Pasuk Aleph through Pasuk Vav, we've seen what we would call the exposition of the story, the setup of the story. We've got all the dramatis personae, Elimelech, who, although he is dead, you will see that he hangs over the Megillah to the end. Machlon and Kilion, who are simply foils, who live and get married and then die in order to bring Ruth and Orpah into the story. The main characters that we are going to deal with for the rest of the first chapter are Naomi, Ruth, and Orpah. And they are right now on their way about to return to Beit Lechem, which of course is a bizarre idea, because to speak about return in the case of three people when two of them have never been there in their lives is an awkward verb. We will see in the next two shiurim that the word to return, lashuv, is the key word in this chapter, and the many ways in which it is used are very telling as to understanding the tension in this chapter. All right, everybody should have a wonderful day, a wonderful evening, and we will continue Mirat Hashem on Thursday night.